Malloy here. Time for another story and another trip through the Wind Door. Listeners, and welcome to Whose Wind Door Is It Anyway? The book review podcast where our theories are made up and the points don't matter.
I approved of this intro ahead of time, audience. It's fine.
The intro there is ruined because I suddenly forgot who did the original version of Whose Line Is It Anyway on the American side, but I remembered Clive Anderson. I was going to introduce you as Clive Anderson, but it didn't work. Oh, well. Fuck it. We're moving on. We are going to be discussing chapters 18 through 20 today of Secret Rooms. And this is going to be, I don't necessarily know that it's going to be a lighter episode than the previous one or the previous two at this point, because we were tackling some pretty weighty stuff going on. And I wasn't sure at first, especially when we were going to be talking about fewer chapters than general, that we were going to have enough to discuss. What I eventually decided was that chapter 20 made for the better cliffhanger, because while chapters 18 through 20 crafted the final set piece of our story, it was the revelation of the Wind Door at the end of chapter 20 that raises the stakes, because it shows us that the magical world does for sure exist. In addition, it's in Chapter 21 that there's a dramatic shift of storytelling perspective. The Vox tube used earlier to record Catherine's story is now used as a way to draw us into the middle of the action for the audio drama. It allows for more mystery, as we are experiencing things at the same time as our protagonists. More diegetic sound, more tension, and more things that we have to interpret for ourselves. But fortunately, when I was putting together my list, I ended up saying, well, I came up with 13 different points here, and when I threw them out to Toby, he came up with like three or four responses to each of them. So I think we're going to have plenty of podcast here.
It will always be an exponential amount of content. We think, okay, three chapters, we can do this. And then Krieger goes on a lecture about metaphysics and different realities and mythologies, and we think, oh no, this will absolutely keep us talking.
So, going to try something a little bit different this time. Well, not that much different. The point is that we've bounced a little bit back between trying to do a synopsis to begin with and then coming back to our talking points or interjecting our talking points as we go, and then coming back and referring to anything that we didn't end up covering. But the way I wrote the discussion notes for today, I hope will work better to help listeners keep track of what's going on here, is that these notes are basically in order of events. So we're not going to be jumping around a whole lot in time here, and that might be more enjoyable for the listener. Obviously, Toby and I will just ramble on and ramble on and then try to come back on topic. And, you know, maybe you can follow all of that and maybe you can't. I feel like in past episodes, it's led to us repeating ourselves a bunch. Your mileage may vary, but let's try this. All right. So first of all, when I began reading chapter 18, one of the things I was reflecting on is that when Secret Rooms originally came out, it was meant to specifically just follow on from the dramatic events of chapter 13, the abandonment. So there is already a feeling of failure that our heroes are trying to come back from, and that affects the events in the new town that they come to, where there are a whole lot of interactions, but it's all sort of like, not quite montage, but there's no interpersonal dialogue there like there was in New Athens. Sorry, blanking on the name of the town there for a second.
Well, it does have two different names within the text, so that's definitely forgivable.
Yeah, in point of fact, Abigail even brings up, the place that I must now refer to as New Athens. The thing that I was thinking about, especially since the experience that I had has always been with the definitive edition, is that the events of part three and the flashback where we have just come off of a major loss for Abigail and James, that means that we are going into chapter 18 feeling like there isn't just failure, there is an open wound. It colors the context when James is going around and trying to be a doctor to everybody in this new small town, and even leaving his doctor's bag with the one person that is capable of using it. The text talks about how the doctor isn't actually very good at his job. It's entirely possible that maybe he was an apprentice to a doctor once upon a time, but didn't have the same kind of training that James himself did. So James takes a moment to be his POTS, not in the matters of eating properly, but in the matters of being a better doctor.
Well, much like in reality, POTS can be used for many different things.
But I'm Tish, that's a great joke. I love it. So one of the things that I had been thinking about, everyone is not talking a whole lot. I mean, that's part of how the beginning of the chapter is laid out. The thing that I was cluing into and that you went into deeper detail is...
Like I do.
Like you do, exactly. Is even though the failure hit Abigail the hardest and Annie was the natural reflection to that, because this is the role that she would normally take. She would normally be the one arguing for a beneficial outcome for the RSA. James himself wasn't directly involved in any of it. He didn't make a whole lot of arguments pro or con. He was letting Abigail and Annie do their thing. And yet he has now gone into the kind of mode that he tended to completely throw himself into back in Weirwood.
Mm.
Just looking at what you've mentioned here, you said he has a burning need to keep others healthy, safe, and alive, with any expense to himself being not much of an issue. And I feel like on some level it's important, because even though he would not seem to have been hit hard by the events in New Athens, it still doesn't change the fact that in previous chapters, he has been brought out of his shell a little bit by Frank and by the interactions in Elkview and all of that kind of thing. And now he is reverting to a more taciturn, work-focused state. It therefore feels like something has been opened up inside him that he's not willing to talk about, either because that's just who he is, or because there is something going on, like it's specifically resonant of the past events that we just covered in part three.
Yes, and it could be that this is the default that he returns to if left to his own devices. And you mentioned that Butler and his interactions with others bring him out of his shell. And at the moment, he is not unclose with Annie. He has shared a conversation with her, but he is certainly, there are very few people around him who are actively trying to bring him out of his shell. So he is kind of being left to his own devices and falling back on the things which he spent a good number of years doing following his greatest failure in his eyes. So maybe if he's part of this group, and even if the failure was taken much more as a personal one for Abigail, I think maybe James wants to be of use, and therefore he views himself as part of the unit. So he might see it as, well, our team's mission was not completed to our satisfaction, therefore I take on some of the responsibility as well. The best way I can counteract this is to help where I can. I see a town where it has a vacancy where a skilled doctor really ought to be, and that is where he can do the most good. So he does the most he can with the time he has. And what's interesting to me personally, and I use that word somewhat correctly, is that when reflecting on this chapter, I actually forgot that this even happened. I recall it as just them immediately arriving at the House of Estect. I thought that there was nothing between Clearwater and the house apart from just the mileage they needed to travel to get there. But this is its own little mini-sode, which does make me think that because it is this small thing that doesn't take up a lot of real estate within the narrative, that it does represent a sort of state of normal, that these events aren't worth noting as much as other ones because they are indicative of what normal is for these characters. And for James, it is helping others and giving so much of himself. In this case, it's represented by him giving away his medical supplies, the things that help him be a doctor, which seems to be how he defines himself. So therefore, he is literally giving up a part of himself to safeguard others because that's what he can do. And he comes second to anything.
Mm. That does actually make me think that part of what James may be responding to is that he does take active roles where he feels that he is the one that can best respond to a situation. But in a lot of cases, particularly in part three, Annie always tends to be the active participant, and James is supporting her. That it was true when they were dealing with Doris. It was true when they set up the events that led to Lucy running off. So that may be partly what he is responding to, is the shock of memory where he was standing there trying to support Abigail in whatever way he could. They failed. And so this is his instinctive response to it.
Mm.
Covering something else that you just mentioned, the fact that this moment is a part of the narrative, it needs to be there because after such an emotional devastation that we had, particularly in the definitive edition, there needs to be a quiet moment where we pull back from that, not just for the characters, but for the readers as well, and sort of lick our wounds to a certain extent. So the fact that this is part of the metaphor of the narrative is very clever, I think.
Absolutely. And what's nice about this quiet moment is it doesn't result in the death of a beloved character.
I'm sorry. Toby, are we having an emotional moment?
I think we're having an emotional moment.
do you need tea and a biscuit?
Oh, I do need tea and biscuit. Wait a minute, the tea and a biscuit was there at the time. No, I'm having a flashback. Oh,
when this happened during the original conversation, it took me a second to realize he was referring to the death of Aunt Cleo. This was honestly more of a bit than anything, but at the time, I had also forgotten that the title of that chapter was called A Quiet Moment. That brings us directly on to point number two, which is when our team of heroes are first approaching the gate to the House of Verstecht, and they are trying to figure out how to get in, and there is a deep consideration from everyone involved about how they want to handle this. Part of the reason why getting beyond the gate is important is that they need a safe place to bed down for the night, and they don't know how dangerous this area is going to be in terms of potential bandits or Wendigo or anything like that. So as Abigail is being the active heroine that she is, and considering the jagged gate, all of a sudden, James has a response, not to anything that she says necessarily, but to just her eyeballing the gate itself, and it's filled with snark.
And it's dripping with snark.
This came out of left field for me, because after he was mostly quiet during the events of the last few chapters, with perhaps the one exception when they were confronting Mayor Buck, and yeah,
sorry, that's just a gag reflex every time that comes up.
We're not going to get too deep into that. We covered plenty of that last time.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things he mentions along the way as they are confronting him with his all-encompassing bigotry is James is just saying offhandedly, "I'm a limey, if that matters." So I guess there is some hint of dry humor going on in the back, but his response here is far more prominent. It's far more acidic. Like, it's still humor, but there is motivation behind it. So I put to you in my initial comments, what did you think was going on here? And I think you managed to cleave very well to a potential interpretation of this moment.
Well, to be balanced, I think that my response to it is very similar to your own. It did take me off guard, even after all this time of being very familiar with James's story, his character's personality. So I know that he can be snarky. He can be very funny as well. And he does make these occasional remarks that come across this way. But even with all of that, it feels like it's quite jarring. It feels like it comes out of left field. And I think that that might be a case of, because this is part of the original text, it's part of the original edition of James. Up till now, we have seen him, the previous chapter was them at Clearwater. So we haven't actually seen a lot of James in the original version of this book. We've seen enough of him that he's a member of the group. Not so much that you are actually aware that the next few chapters are going to be all about just James and Abigail. If you view this without those extra chapters that tell their story of their past at and their childhood at Weirwood, it's very easy to think that this is a story about Captain Annie and her interactions with her new squad mates. And so when she leaves and the story centers on these two, it does become a bit of a shift.
I mean, one could point out the logic of the cover, wherein Abigail and James's faces are large and Annie is more in the background. But putting that to one side and having listened to the old non-definitive edition by now, Toby makes a good point.
And so because of that, what I'm trying to get to is that in the original version, it's even more jarring. And I think it might be that Alex was getting to grips with interlacing James's snark and his somewhat sardonic humor with his usual disposition so that it is there alongside his day-to-day personality when he's just getting on with things, so that you know it's part of who he is. It's not something separate. But I think that in this one instance, it does feel like something separate. It feels like, oh, there's this aspect of this character that I'm just learning about now or is being particularly highlighted now. It's abrupt, so, and I think that over time Alex gets a bit more familiar, and with these added chapters I think that shows itself, that he's comfortable with allowing James to be sniffy in his own time rather than something that comes out and he sort of comes forward and offers his snark unprompted, as I tend to do myself. But anyway, moving on. The only hint in this definitive edition that we've had, or a hint rather, I think listeners are inclined to see and read this aspect of his personality in a bunch of different areas. And for me, the other area that comes to mind is when Abigail and James were drinking Dr. Potts's sarsaparilla, and when Abigail shows, oh, I had no idea that was sarsaparilla. And he's like, what, you didn't know it was sarsaparilla? There's that kind of indignation that she didn't have a plan. And you can see that that is the same motivation fueling these two interactions. It's a flash of their old relationship with one another, where he would be the person who would look at her and say, no, don't do that, it's not safe, and you've already done it, why did you do that? And so I
don't
think
do the
that,
thing, I'm a do the thing.
I'm a do it. James, it's this moment where I think that flash, I think, comes because there is this history shared between the two, that he has probably seen this happen dozens of times and can recall it. So he's almost, with him coming forward and unprompted and saying and concocting the scenario and then saying, oh wait, that would be a stupid idea, don't do that thing, is probably because he knows Abigail's thought process and can anticipate it. So it's a combination of things. I think that it may be Alex getting to grips with how James's humor works in conversation or feels natural in the conversation. But I think that there is enough there in this version of the text that it feels warranted, or it feels like you can understand it.
Toby's suggestion is that there is possibly this established dynamic between them from 9 years of the two interacting. I'd like to posit that this sort of verbal sparring might only have been a result of those early days, and might have actually gone to sleep after the death of Lucy and the two of them being separated. It would require familiarity, after all. Which is why it's only waking up now after all this time. That could reflect the strength of the reaction. And as far as Alex's characterization of James himself, let's not forget that the inspiration was partly based on Robert Downey Jr.'s depiction of Sherlock Holmes. That version of Sherlock was highly unlikely to shut up, even when it would be more diplomatic to do so. I suspect that this is a way of James being different, but Abigail, of all people, is one who can trigger his emotional side in ways others don't. So, they managed to get beyond the gate, and this is where we finally get our first view of the House of Verstecht, the Gothic set piece for the final act of our story. And I did not actually twig to this at the time. It actually took all of our conversation about Let Them Go and then having a moment where I was doing things like looking at the cover to secret rooms. I think there was also a specific tweet by Alex where he was making reference to secret rooms because he was putting out chapters of the audio drama on a separate feed for people to get into if they want. And the house that he used as an image to... it wasn't the cover of Secret Rooms itself. It was just this black and white image of a house that, like, triggered a memory in me back from when I was looking at specific books from the Gothic genre that were significant that people would know about. And the house made me think of... I actually went back and confirmed, yep, that's exactly what I was thinking of. The House of Verstecht, as portrayed in this tweet, looked like the house in the House of the Fall of Usher. And that's when I suddenly had the, oh, this is a Gothic narrative too. How did I not see that before? Immediately after this, Toby and I went on a bit of a tangent on the false-seeming paradox of this realization, which I am simplifying here because the actual conversation gets muddled. As established by a fictional timeline and our own retrospective, Let Them Go comes before Secret Rooms. But obviously in publication history, original Secret Rooms was written in 2015, and Let Them Go came out 3 years after that. It's not really accurate to say that one caused the other, especially since the goals of the two books were entirely different. What is clear to us now is that Alex and Sharon love gothic narratives, so having two books with that flavor should not be a shock. We have a little bit of a complex situation here where I'm reviewing the notes that we have, and chapter 18 is where we first get to know, we first see the House of Verstekt, but it's also where we get to meet our new characters that are going to lead us into the final act of Secret Rooms. So do we want to talk about the house first, or do we want to talk about the characters first? Because they sort of mesh a little bit, and we get the outside of the house in chapter 18, but we get a sense of more of the inside of the house in chapter 19. So
shall we do the house since we're on the subject? Because
yeah.
I think that whichever way you go, a bit like, oh, do we go with Secret Rooms next or Cartographer's Handbook next?
Yeah.
There is a sense of, well, both are good, so let's do this one.
All right.
So you made the comparison to the House of Usher, and I'm curious to follow up on your thoughts with that.
Well, here I bring up the memory of those graphic novel versions of classic literature that I used to read in my preteens again. Because I'm pretty sure a complete explanation of that exists somewhere in our backlog, I am once more shortening our original conversation down to the relevant facts. I remember the fall of the House of Usher as being one of those, but the events and the mental images from that graphic novel utterly escape me now. That said, to be honest, if I were to actually think of a gothic edifice that the House of Verstekt would have reminded me of, it would have been the aging manor of Great Expectations, which was laid
Yes.
out in a lot of detail, where there was just rotting wood and cobwebs everywhere. And I don't necessarily do well with the written detail, but when it was laid out in the graphic novel, it was far easier to get a sense of this was a dying, dilapidated place that someone was still choosing to live in.
I think that the advantage that those graphic novel adaptations of these classic stories have is that, like you, sometimes when all the detail is written down for sentences and sentences, paragraphs and paragraphs, pages and pages, I get too fixated on taking in each individual detail, and therefore I'm not really getting a sense of the whole picture. I can't see the forest for the trees is the best comparison. But with a single static image or a collection of them that gives you all of those details in one complete package, it helps you see how they all, each of those details comes together to create one vision of a location, a person, their costume. And, you know, the quality of those, the drawings and the adaptations will vary, of course.
Mm-hmm.
That comes with the territory. But I think that that makes an impression for me for any fictional location. The details will always be important, but it's how they come together and the lasting impression, which is, what is the feeling I'm drawing from this? And for Great Expectations, for me, it always felt like this is a house that should have been abandoned long ago, and even the people look like more cobweb than flesh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I think on my initial response to Ravenwood and the House of Verstekt, the House of Verstekt left less of an impression on me physically. It was more about the events that happened there than how the place actually looked at first. And that's because when Rebecca is going on to describe Ravenwood, there are emotions associated with the place for her, and she goes into a lot of detail that have those emotions tied to it. So long before you and I did a thorough synopsis of the overall aura and experience of Ravenwood, is how it affects Rebecca in during their initial journey to the place, as she's exploring it again after not being here since she was a child, and then later as she's going on to the basement as well. All of that heightened the tension and the experience. Here in the House of Respect, there is less descriptive detail to what is going on. It mentions that the house is in more of a state of disrepair, but it's also very dark in general. When they're going around, they need a candle in order to see their way, and that's going to become very important in the final chapters of Part 4 in particular. But the thing that James himself notices is that it's been left to a state of disrepair, possibly because there was no one there to appreciate it aside from himself, since Gerda is blind. And so therefore, in order to make the House of Respect comfortable for them both, he focused more on smells and sounds and other things that would be important to Gerda, and left a lot of the visual stuff that were not important to them to just rot. That's the one significant moment about the House of Respect, and so therefore it stands out in comparison to the greater detail of Ravenwood. In retrospect, one can understand the difference in kind here in regards to the way the two houses are portrayed. While both stories have mysteries to be solved, the contents of Let Them Go are personal and connected to our protagonist. In Secret Rooms, the experience of James and Abigail is more like Jonathan Harker entering Dracula's castle, or Edith Cushing entering Crimson Peak. Not completely understanding what they are in for, and the details of their environment are the clues they need to unravel it.
In addition to that, not only is he focusing on the smells, but he abandons the upper level of it because for Greta it's not something she needs and therefore it serves no function, so they sever it. And to me, what Ravenwood feels like is a skeleton. You can see the life that was once there, but you can also feel this, there is this unavoidable sense of death or something being absent. In the House of Respect, what it reminds me of is a brain, a human mind, where part of the mind has been disconnected.
Huh. Okay.
That will be a comparison that I will go into more detail later on, but for the time being, it's because I think for Krieger, he is focusing all his efforts on taking care of Greta. It's a very short-term plan which looks into day-to-day survival, and I think that I am not the expert to listen to on this, but it reminds me of what I've heard about of the brain shutting down non-essential things when it has, or certain chemical stimulants just get suppressed and in favor of the things that are far more essential, or it feels are far more essential. And I think that's what Krieger is doing with what he lets go of versus what he enhances and tends to.
The names of the places are significant to how they are presented as well. The words that you used when you were thinking about this is that Ravenwood is fantastical and connected with experienced and remembered trauma, where Verstekt is the one with secret and unrecognizable science and connected with the ethereal. So if we look at the actual names of these places, as far as the Raven is associated with Poe and other, some of the darker themes that he talks about in things like The Telltale Heart or The Fall of the House of Usher, there's a natural reason why that is the mental image that we would come up with even before anyone does any description as to the nature of that particular home.
It also has certain mythological significance of, Odin's Raven, etc. But meanwhile?
I was going to say, meanwhile, as is pointed out in the text, several books later, and which you brought back to the fore here, versteckt is German for hidden. So, yes, the reason why we can't see the rot of the House of Versteckt is because it's dark, and therefore it's hidden.
Or indeed, secret, and we are exploring its rooms.
In addition, when you were thinking about what other places you thought of in comparison to Ravenwood and Versteckt, the thing that I find the most intriguing is that you associated Ravenwood with Allerdale Hall of the movie Crimson Peak, and I can definitely see what you're talking about there. Obviously, there is a connotation to Crimson Peak, which is not present in Let Them Go itself, because it's a place of darkness, but it's not necessarily a place of evil, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And for Versteckt, you associated the Spencer estate of the original Resident Evil game. Mm-hmm. And while I can definitely get behind those general interpretations, there was actually just a conversation on the Discord. Alex is doing one of those things where he shows his work, so to speak, shows all the influences that contributed to one of his novels.
And of course, Greg and I are going to eat that shit up.
Yeah, of course. Anytime Alex opens his mouth about anything New Century, we're just already like, you know, dog with the nose around the corner being like, I like food.
We just open the wind door a peek and are just sort of peeking our eyes around.
Yeah. Resident Evil was actually a major influence to Let Them Go. I may try to splice that in to some of the episodes that I'm still editing, because we're still in the past here, we're still working on the episodes of Let Them Go. So I may try to include a little bit of that as an aside in the edit. I was about to cut in here with a clever narrator retort that I had done that, but to be honest, I find myself now wondering if I used this idea to full effect during the original review. It's been months now, and I've moved on to other things. Since I can't be sure, I'm leaving in some of the conclusions I came to during this conversation. Better late than never. But mm-hmm. I can definitely see the influences of Resident Evil specifically on Let Them Go, because the house starts to open up as things get more serious, much as the way the Spencer estate starts to open up as things get more serious. We gain access to weapons, we gain access to different parts of the house, and being able to maneuver those various parts of the house becomes important in order to survive. There are definitely elements of that in secret rooms as well, I would have to say. It's just these are the introductory episodes, so we don't necessarily get into... We haven't gotten to the all is lost moment yet.
And it's something which I think the comparison comes to mind for me because of this specific sequence of events that mirror each other, because our heroes, who are a team of government agents, are seeking refuge and find a mysterious house in the middle of nowhere, which was not their original intended destination, but hey, it will do. So they go inside, and there is a certain amount of strange, unknowable science going on within, with Krieger talking about his theories on Pandora's box and different worlds, and it is something that they were not anticipating. It takes them by surprise, and it kind of changes the game when we actually see that his theories may be much more than theories, considering how chapter 20 ends, but we'll get there, trust us.
And of course, eventually we have the Wendigo invading on the territory, so yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm just waiting for James to go to Abigail and say, you were almost an Abigail sandwich.
I'm glad that most of our listeners are actually fellow geeks, because I'm relatively certain there are going to be a few people listening to this, very likely my parents, that will not get any of this at all. But trust.
I'm sorry, Greg's parents.
but trust us, like, as Eddie is, I would say, this is fucking funny. all right, so that's the house itself. In addition to that, another one of the visual components of the house that I went into a little bit of a digression on were the presence of Edelweiss, the small flowers that are remarked upon by Abigail and Annie when they first enter the property. Obviously, the fact that one of the unrecognizable flowers are called Charlotte's, that will become more significant in a moment, but that's part of the text. They don't actually talk all that much about Edelweiss as a flower, so I was curious and started going on a small Wikipedia search for what the significance of Edelweiss were. And apparently this flower is pretty significant to Germans in general, because when I was looking through the various uses of it in terms of both a flower and a symbol, it turns out that it was both used as a symbol by anti-Nazi youth groups back in the day, but was also used by parts of the German army during World War II. So it's like everyone was trying to get in on this, basically, and that, which makes me think that Edelweiss were significant to Germans in general. I mean, heck, the name Edelweiss is German, so I guess it can't be all that surprising. On top of that, first and foremost, Edelweiss is a symbol of purity, which doesn't really have a great connotation when you think of the fact that the Nazis were using it, but
No. No, thank you.
But when we get to some of the, you know, just the fact that this was a flower that was capable of surviving in cold climates, basically just tenacity and survival in harsh conditions, it naturally brings out certain potential metaphorical and metaphysical themes to why it is that Krieger and Greta have that here. It seems very likely that they would have brought it with them. They themselves are German, or at the very least Krieger is. We never actually find out what nationality Greta is. But the idea of this being a flower that is surviving after the world has gone to pot with the Wendigo, that feels like it has some significance going on in there. And when we get into some of the conversation with Krieger's discussion of his beliefs and Pandora's box and all of that, you mentioned that he believes in the value of hope in the face of adversity, the balance between the extremes of madness and supreme bliss and harmony, and that Edelweiss might be symbolic of the importance of that opposing force, the thing that exists to counteract and go against its opposite, ensuring that the world isn't lost to the abyss that it would fall into if the scales were tipped too far. That's a great moment here. I'm probably going to excise that and have that be the quote that we're going to use when this finally gets posted to the website. But
fantastic. Yeah, I think it really is that, and it almost the conflicting usage of two different sides trying to claim the symbolic value of it almost seems to add to that, where it is this thing which represents the opposition between the cold and this plant life. It is something that does show that. And, you know, lest we forget, it is also a particularly remembered and well-loved song from The Sound of Music. And I haven't seen that film, I'm sorry. But I think it's meant to be a symbolic of the hope of pushing against the encroaching darkness.
I have seen The Sound of Music a couple of times, but I will be frank. I don't know what song you're referring to. I'm probably going to end up looking that thing up and dropping it into the edit when we finally get this far. But okay. Interesting. I decided not to actually put the song itself into the episode, as it's long enough as it is. But I did put a link to the song in the show notes, as well as a link to a news article that came up when I researched it. The article specifically talks about how the song, at least, is not emblematic of the Nazi regime, and is, in fact, representative of Captain von Trapp's love of Austria, but resistance to the Nazis. To quote the article, it's the very definition of an anti-Nazi song. Let's start talking about the people. And when I say let's start talking about the people, as is obvious by this point, I have been digging into every nook and cranny, not simply of the books in general thus far, but when I was worried that I wouldn't have enough to talk about for these three chapters, I started looking into everything. So I was immediately looking at, okay, do the names of our new characters here have some sort of significance?
Oh, I'm sure there's not too much. Oh, there's a lot.
Yeah, because when I was thinking about it, and I was like, Krieger, I know that word. I know that word because it's come up some point in my cluster of geek ephemera that Krieg means war in German. Once upon a time when I read some Captain America comics, I happened across some German superheroes that were trying to bring the Red Skull to justice for their own reasons. It turns out that Germany has its own version of Cap, called Hauptmann Deutschland, as well as two allies named Blitzkrieger and Zeitgeist. I don't have much to add, other than that's likely where I first learned the etymology, and then to cue up Bob Chipman.
Comics are weird!
Which means yes. That when you go into the direct translation, Krieger means warrior or soldier in German.
So Krieg would mean war, and if it's a Krieger, it's much the same that you have war and the warrior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I decided to dive a little bit deeper into that and think about, that's an interesting name, especially considering the role that Krieger plays. He would not appear to be a warrior of any kind. He is a man of intellect, much like James himself. James generally doesn't want to try and get into conflict, or at the very least doesn't want to pick up a gun because of his Hippocratic Oath getting in the way of that. Krieger does not seem to have any such limitations on him because he is a man of science, but he is not specifically an MD doctor.
He does carry a gun with him at the end of chapter 20 self-defense, but it shows that he is prepared to use it.
Yeah, exactly. So that one thing made me curious and therefore want to delve into further. And I delved into a lot, and unfortunately, you're going to have to wait a long time before you hear some of our other fascinating conclusions, because Krieger and Greta themselves don't show up again for many
a hot
books.
Minute.
Yeah, exactly.
let's put it this way. There are people who are up-to-date fans of the audio drama of New Century, and we can't talk to them about the full significance of the name.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll just put a pin in it. Everything's written down at this point. So
we're going to come back to it and be like, oh, there's still this pin in it. And it's
what's this pin over here? Yeah, exactly.
So, this is all true.
Greta. Greta means pearl in German. And that feels like it's significant to a certain degree because it reflects on how Krieger treats her.
Mm-hmm. He does treasure her. And not only that, but he keeps her hidden away from the world like a pearl inside an oyster in a secret corner of the vast sea. It's also indicative of the unique powers that she conceals, and we finally get to see in chapter 20. It's as if she is unassuming on the surface. She seems very elegant and graceful and charming, and it's one of those moments where when I first read the book, I was very interested to get to know her further, and then she shows something completely out of left field, and it makes you reevaluate what little you know about her, and it's that the power of those starlit eyes, and those starlit eyes also come into play to me, because the idea of the starlit eyes calls to mind the image of shining glints in a dark ocean, much like pearls in the dark ocean, for me to clumsily dissect this metaphor.
Yeah, I can see that. But that is not the only name that Greta has. And this may well be one of the Easter eggs that potentially went unpacked up until you and I decided to look at, to do this deep dive. For all I know, someone else noticed it and mentioned it to Alex privately, because it's not something that's come up on the Discord so far. When Krieger is communing with Greta, and he uses a very elaborate word in German to refer to her, it's elaborate because it's one of those things that German language does, where it basically combines a whole bunch of existing words into one long, drawn-out thing that may or may not end up being incorporated to other people's lexicons. Like, the one that most people are familiar with is Schadenfreude, which translated means the delight in the misfortune of others. I don't know what the individual components of that particular word are, but it's short enough and it's used enough that it's a thing that people are often familiar with in English, at the very least. I have no way of knowing how you pronounce this.
I was going to ask you to say this, because I'm looking at this and I'm looking at it at every angle and I'm thinking, I'm not touching this.
Honestly, the simplest thing to do would be to just play it as the actor voiced it on the audio drama. And so...
Advance, meine Nichtsteinmenschliche Frau.
It runs over the top of it so fast in the audio drama and in the text that you don't necessarily know that there's anything significant going on there. It's only on Riri where I'm just like, that's a really long word. What does it mean in English? Is there a translation for that? I feel like there must be, because this isn't a book in German, so therefore Alex must have intended something with this. And when I put it into just straight Google at first, the thing that came up of all things was actually a transcript from an episode of the American TV show Frasier, which is not something I ever would have expected. More specifically, when I put it into a German to English translation, and the episode of Frasier actually mentions this as well, I wanted to confirm at this point, it means non-human woman. And yeah, cue the interested sound that the Skeksis make in Dark Crystal there. That's a hell of a giveaway right there. And the only reason why, like, that's literally an Easter egg, because in the narrative itself, we get to the part where we find out that Greta is unusual to begin with as a part of the plot. But you don't necessarily know that Alex is potentially giving the game away unless you take the time to find out what that word means. So I feel like that's the best kind of Easter egg. It's something that he just puts it in plain sight, like Pandora's box, and dares you to open it. And maybe you don't do that, but
I think he's daring the listener or the reader, saying, what are you going to do, listen back to it and then take the effort to Google translate it, or are you going to listen to more of the chapter? Yeah, I thought so.
Da, 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 da. Oh, look at that.
Those two people like it, and they're shagging.
I'm sorry, this is the place my mind goes to, is just every now and then inserting a little bit of Eddie Izzard, whether it makes any sense or not. And then we have Charlotte, who we only learn the smallest amount of information about now in these chapters. The name translated here, this isn't a German name. This is actually one that translates from French, and it means free. That's an interesting potential, not necessarily spoiler, but you could continue to unpack that a little. We know that she's passed on at this point, but we also know, or it has been heavily alluded to at least, that she is an artist that she is the one that did the painting that Abigail is referring to in chapter 19, and James is quickly cutting her off, saying, maybe we don't want to dive too quickly. No, actually, she doesn't know that Charlotte painted it. She asks if Krieger or Greta did, and James has already figured out that it's very likely Charlotte's painting and doesn't want to bring up ill memories of the dead in front of their host. But it's not hard to draw that inference there.
I think that James is a very helpful and healthy representation of a neurodiverse character, because the trope is always for someone with a mind like his to be very blunt and socially unconscious, and that is things that people struggle with, and there is definitely a place for it. My point here is that the expectation would be that if someone is going to step on someone's emotional toes, that it would be James. But there are several moments, and this is one of them, where he holds back on that. And I think that that shows that for as much as James is very much up inside his own head, that he does connect with other people and has a desire to and an empathy for others.
Yeah, he's neurodivergent, but the thing that he does that benefits him in this particular case is that he's constantly thinking 10 steps ahead. And so as he's listening to Krieger speak or is remembering things that have been said previously, he's already gotten to the end of the page and is therefore able to react quickly, much like the Robert Downey Sherlock Holmes is able to predict the exact events of a fight based on the lightning fast way he's thinking, in terms of, if I do this, this will happen, then I do this, then I do that. This is the non-combat version of that, much as we have seen previously when he's analyzing the scene of the Wendigo, both in the original attack and when they found the bodies.
This is how you think?
Like this, but faster.
All right.
Returning to Charlotte.
Returning to Charlotte, but I think for the moment we're actually going to leave that conversation behind, because Charlotte, as I mentioned just a moment ago, Charlotte becomes more important in the chapters that we have yet to cover. So we'll talk about more ways in which her name is significant when we get there.
Yeah, we'll plant the seed, we've watered it, we'll come back to it once it's grown a little.
Yeah. In 2 weeks, you're going to have a Charlotte. No. Sorry, you just set that up and I couldn't not hit it out of the park.
And you did.
We then went on a brief tangent about how there was a metaphor inherent in Greta and Krieger shutting themselves away from the world, much the way people are during quarantine. But I don't think there's much more useful to say that wasn't covered in Chapter 10. And talking about all the people that aren't staying inside and trying to prevent the spread is just depressing. So, let's instead talk about Cthulhu.
This is much easier to wrap my head around.
Yeah, exactly. We joke here, but we're now getting to the actual meat of the Pandora's Box episode and the discussion of that particular myth and the many, many things that Krieger has to say about it. This is one of those instances where I was drawn into what is going on in the audio drama, but it actually really helped to have the text of the book itself close at hand, because that particular chapter throws so much stuff at you that it's easy to feel like you can forget things that are being said along the way. But it also meant that in places, during my original listen through way back when, and through listening to it again for the purposes of preparing for this podcast, I couldn't always understand what he was saying. He meeting Krieger, since I apparently didn't make that clear in the original conversation. So being able to refer to the pure English, which is not written with an accent in mind, helped me to understand all the various stuff that got brought up in conversation. Krieger is talking a lot. He is taken center stage and is on his soapbox here now that he has someone that he can unload his mind to that isn't Greta. As he mentions himself, having them here is a breath of fresh air, and he mentions at some point, I'm already missing you, because he's looking forward to the point where they're no longer going to be present and therefore can't have these deeper conversations with. So on some level, it could be like he's trying to get out all the potential things he could say to them while they're still here.
Going forward to chapter 20 and what he and Greta do, it's almost like he is conscious of the fact that they are kind of like a flight risk, in the sense that they are already aware that Annie has mentioned that more cartographers and more soldiers are likely to come this way, whether they try and prevent that or not, because now that this place has been discovered and now that they've said that they would like to help them in the way that they can, the cat's out of the bag, in a sense. So he is using this time he has with these two. He's gone on record to say that he's hesitant to let other people in. So if he's going to choose anyone, it's probably going to be these two while he has them here. And he's aware that he and Greta might get out of there before things get too hot. This is probably the best time to give away as much as he can for right now.
Are you saying that this house, it isn't secret? It isn't safe? Sorry. I was holding on to that and just letting you talk, but I was like trying to listen and remember that at the same time.
You have a lot more self-restraint than I do, my friend.
Well, only because I want to be able to say it and not have it get mixed up with other conversation on the podcast. So, but Pandora's Box.
Yep.
This is a myth I'm pretty familiar with at this point. If you're a fan of mythology, then Greek mythology is, you know, going to be your backyard. And so the second I saw that this was going to be a chapter title, I was like, oh, okay, sit down and like have no other distractions as we dive into this.
It's about to get academic.
Academic, but I mean, you know, there's also potentially creative aspects to it, which is part of what James actually gets into this, because after Krieger has done his whole spiel, he mentions how he was enraptured by some of it when we were talking about purely logical stuff and the ways that he is being a bit of a futurist and thinking about the world as it might have gone on had the Wendigo never intervened, discussing various metaphysical topics that still have a basis in science. It's when he starts talking about things like, I'm sorry, going back down to my notes here, what is the term he uses? Oh yes, the devourer of time and the killer of gods. That's where Krieger starts to lose James a little bit.
And you've lost me. What's kind of fascinating is that while he may be losing James by going on this more emotive journey with the ideas that he's describing, it's almost as if he is, whether intentionally or by accident, he is almost appealing to both James and Abigail through the language that will appeal to them. For James, it's these logical hypotheticals of, consider the possibility of these other versions of reality where this didn't happen, where this wasn't introduced. And I think to Abigail, there is this powerful sense of imagine the possibilities, that feeling of needing to get out, because she has always wanted to go beyond the confines of what the people above her have imposed on her. She wanted to leave Weirwood. So wouldn't the idea of these journeys to other worlds be appealing to her, or at least intrigue her enough to sit up and take attention?
I feel like that is probably definitely what Alex intended. I don't necessarily know that that's what Krieger intended, because he does have that moment where he is focused entirely on James, and Abigail cuts in with, "Hey, I'm a treasure too." And he's just sort of like, yes, very dismissive to a certain extent. But you're absolutely correct in that between the two of them, they're able to understand all of the components of what Krieger is offering here. It just so happens that that's Abigail's strength as opposed to James' strength.
This is actually tying into something that was momentarily explored in the additional chapters with Lucy when she is looking up at the stars and thinking about how infinitely vast the universe is and how if nothing matters, then everything matters. She is considering their existence in the infinite breadth of reality. And what's really revealing is that while Krieger, his reaction is unhinged, feels uncharitable, but it has certainly left a mark on him that I think that he is still coming to terms with. Lucy has found, actually managed to find a solution to the existential crisis of seeing the endless breadth of reality and her place in it, and she's managed to find not just a way to live with it, but to actually take solace from it.
Well, but it's also a question of scope, isn't it? Because Lucy is still only having to deal with the devastation of the world that she lives in. Krieger is coming from a place of he is no longer bound to one world, it would seem. He has seen the breadth and depth of the multiverse, so to speak, and therefore it has potentially broken him a little. So it's a significant theme of specifically Lovecraft, and this is where we finally understand why it was Lovecraft's poem that was invoked. Lovecraft's poem was specifically talking about Poe, which tends to focus far more on darkness that the average person can relate to, even if it's something like the Mask of the Red Death, which is a representation of pestilence, or whether it's the horror and the trap of the pit and the pendulum, or the darkness inside people's souls, such as the fall of the House of Usher or the Telltale Heart. Lovecraft is the one that takes what he learned from Poe and goes beyond the realm of human imagining to discuss ideas that are beyond our comprehension, and that if we attempt to comprehend them, then we will, there is a form of destruction that will take place on ourselves. And so therefore it has affected him, and we're not going to be exploring much more of the cosmic aspects of his assertions in Secret Rooms, because there are smaller issues that have to be resolved first. But as the two of us have read everything that Alex has written up to this point, it's hard not to wonder, as the story continues to open up, whether some of these terms and ideas and metaphors that Krieger brings up are going to come into play, specifically, say, down the pike in the Infinity War of New Century Hidden Doors. So, yeah, that's when we say we're going to get to that, we haven't even gotten to that yet. It'll come eventually.
Just to go back to the poem that Alex chooses of Lovecraft's, I re-listened to that after you brought it up, and I think you're absolutely right. This is where it comes into focus, because the poem speaks of a specter who walks among these dark places, these hidden worlds, and is unseen by all except those who understand the sorcery. And to me, that almost seems to be analogous to those who understand the sorcery being those who take a glimpse into these other dimensions and come to understand the real scope of things. And this spectre in the poem is the shade of Poe. Mm. And I believe it's also alluding to Krieger. He is the one who has seen the Devourer of Time, Killer of Gods, who has seen and dwells infinitely on the boundless breadth of existence, and he keeps himself hidden away from the rest of reality, who would not know that he or Charlotte were ever there. So he is that shade who is unseen by all except those who come close to the sorcery that he is conscious of.
Well, bringing the scope back a couple of notches, Pandora's Box more specifically, the metaphor of Pandora's Box could easily be one of human nature. Like, Krieger himself talks about how the original myth was centered around curiosity, which he himself views as a boon rather than a bane, and also reflects on what it's meant to say about women, that it was a woman that couldn't do as she was told and open the box when she was told not to.
Audio equivalent of an eye roll.
While I was editing this bit, I went back to review the myth as well as other stories that show that curiosity can lead to a great tragedy. Greek mythology in particular has tons of them besides Pandora's Box. But on review, I was reminded that myth is more than just blaming a woman for evil existing, much the way that Eve is castigated for eating the apple. Zeus designed the box as a punishment. He made it because Prometheus gave fire to humans, and he gave it to Pandora, a woman specifically crafted to be curious. Zeus wanted the box to be opened. He just set things up so he could throw the blame at someone else. One could instead just say that Pandora's Box is a reflection of human nature, that humanity has a tendency to create its own problems where none potentially existed before, but hope is always going to be there. Hope must always be nurtured, and that is one of the, well, it is the founding theme of New Century in general. So the fact that this was one of the first novels in the series means that this could be the flashpoint of that particular idea. We'll get into Cartographer's Handbook eventually, but that the experience of that is more dry, and it's mostly discussing the things that Arlington feels need to happen in order for hope to not be extinguished. This is more of the psychological and mythological underpinnings of that idea. We fucked up, or not even that we fucked up, things have been fucked up. We can't fall into despair.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, one of the things that he talks about, he meaning Krieger, in this elaborate monologue is that he feels that the presence of James and Abigail is meant to be a harbinger of that hope. Harbinger, it tends to be the kind of word you use when you're talking about someone that is the herald of something bad rather than the herald of something good. But in this particular case, this could very well be part of the reason why he talks as much as he does. He literally says, "What your Thomas Arlington is doing is good. I want to support it any way I can." But he's not talking about supporting it through any physical resources that he has. He is talking about saying as much as he can in order to open up the minds of these emissaries of a potential brighter future. And he has as well other things in mind, which we will get into in the final chapters, as well as make reference to much further down the line in one of the last books of the series that have been published thus far. But yeah, he is saying, you are a hope of something good to come out of all of this. Therefore, I'm going to throw everything at the wall and hope something sticks, because as we know from the events of, as you were saying not long ago, as we know from the events of Chapter 20, they are not planning on sticking around. Like, things collapse far earlier than he might have expected. It may well be that they decided they were going to move on after James and Abigail and Annie left. But then things happen the way they do, and they end up having to leave under far more dramatic circumstances instead. So,
well, time for me to hit the old dusty trail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's some of the stuff that the narrative isn't trying to get into, but also Krieger himself is trying to get into. Leave somebody else with as much information as possible and hope that it helps things come out better. Because as the way this story presents Krieger specifically, he may have a name that means warrior. It doesn't seem like he's going to stick around and fight. Or at the very least, he is not going to be fighting for the future of this world and the United States. His focus is all on, say, protecting this valuable pearl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so obviously there are potentially other things that could be gotten into here, but this episode has been going on a while to begin with, and it's probably something that we can revisit later on in the final wrap-up of Secret Rooms. Mm-hmm. So here we move on to one of my favorite dramatic moments of Secret Rooms, where after Krieger has finally finished talking, and I don't necessarily know that I saw this in my mind when I first listened to Secret Rooms, but it definitely felt very present on re-listening, which is the story suddenly shifts to Abigail as she is considering everything that has happened and is suddenly hearing the encroaching Wendigo, and the feeling that this whole thing has is very evocative of Ian McKellen as Gandalf reading out the final words of the dwarves in the Mines of Moria. And it has this crack of doom associated with it. There's audio stuff in there as well, but even just the fearful way that Abigail is saying, but also very specifically writing, because this is meant to be a journal entry here, the last moment before Chapter 20, itself titled The Game Changes, it just feels all very Mines of Moria.
You can certainly envision, if this was written down, that it would be quite scratchy, it would be a bit rushed, there would be mistakes, it would be very frantic, and yep, it is very drums in the deep, and it's exactly, and it's a very similar, and it could be, if everything goes poorly, the exact same scenario, in that if the in-universe explanation of, or the framing of the narration is that this is being written down in their journals, for all you know, there could be an Ian McKellen type who has stumbled across James and Abigail's journals and is reading this, and it's just that last line of,
"They have taken the bridge and the second hall. We have barred the gates, but cannot hold them for long. The ground shakes. Drums, drums in the deep. We cannot get out. A shadow moves in the dark. We cannot get out. They are coming."
It's so tense, especially for the reader or listener who is done let them go first, because they know how bad these things can mess people up firsthand. And it is the moment that they're finally back in a very real way. In other places, they've been kind of seen from a distance or seen after the fact. Here, it's not just that they're back again. It's, wait a minute, we're in a gothic manor house. Oh, son of a bitch.
That's exactly the wrong place to be when the Wendigo attack. God damn it. Abigail herself reflects on that these might be the last words she writes. So that is what dovetails into the words that invoke that particular part of Fellowship of the Ring. But one of the things you bring up here is reflective of one of the last notes that I had. One of the things that I was heavily reflective on for Let Them Go because of the artwork was how it made me think of Aliens. The moment where Ripley is preparing her weapons and riding the elevator down into the depths of the reactor to get Newt back. But narratively speaking, Let Them Go is really more akin to Alien, because there is, well, okay, there, at first it seems like there is only one Barghest, and it turns out later that there is more than one. But the point is that eventually she is the only one left to deal with everything that's going on, and she is the lone survivor as well, and it's far more intimate overall. Secret Rooms, on the other hand, feels a lot more thematically resonant to Aliens, and there are a couple of things going on there. First of all, the number of Wendigos is uncountable at this point. It's dark, there's woods. We actually have no idea how many Wendigo there are. There's also things like Annie has to go for help in order to make sure that they all make it out alive, much as the way Bishop had to leave the rest of them in order to bring down the dropship in the movie.
Yeah.
It feels like there is a moment of betrayal with Krieger just getting out of Dodge with Greta in tow, or rather Greta helping Krieger get out of Dodge because Greta is the one with the power in this particular circumstance. That feels a little bit like the betrayal of the company man, Burke. And most importantly, and Alex has said this many times, but I had forgotten again until he brought it up recently during a conversation on the Discord. There is a moment where Abigail is pounding on the door of the House of Verstekt because they had to go out in order to deal with the horses and get Annie, you know, out the gate and looking for reinforcements. But now they have to get back into the house for safety, and the door is locked. And so she is pounding on the door and going,
"Come on, goddammit!"
And that is directly meant to be an invocation of a similar moment in the movie Aliens, where Ripley has finally gotten Newt, but she's down to her last ammunition, and they just need to be able to get up the elevator to the dropship, and they have to wait for this fucking slow elevator to get there, and in the meantime, she doesn't know how many potential aliens she has coming after her. As Alex and Sharon are the brains behind School of Movies, it should not be shocking that New Century is filled with these homages to other movies, especially movies that are personally resonant to them. Alex's writing and Sharon's performance of it just happens to work exceptionally well in that moment.
Yeah, and there's, in the wider narrative, there's even a theme of an uncertain mistrust of the company and the organization you are joining after years of isolation away from wider society. Just like how James and Abigail are joining the cartographers, are part of Arlington's governmental movement to reunify, and there are things which don't quite sit right with these two protagonists.
Yeah, in terms of some of the things that they're experiencing along the way, questioning some of the things that were in the handbook that brought them in to begin with as well. Yeah, no, there's a greater thread even beyond these chapters themselves, which lend themselves a great deal to this movie in particular. The thing that I'm reflecting on, when I mentioned, hey, it's invoking of aliens, it is significant that each of the books have multiple sources of influence. And when we finally do the last wrap-up on Secret Rooms, one of the things that I'm going to try and post is a little image that Alex came up with that shows the through line between all of the movies that contributed to the telling of Secret Rooms. He's done that now for most of his books. Sometimes it's just a list of all of them, but for some of them he did a little bit of a graphic that includes the poster for each of the movies that were an influence on the storytelling from in chronological order leading to BAM, this particular story. So I will include that. It will help expand your own thinking on saying, oh yeah, this came from that and that came from that. So that'll be a good little snippet that I'll throw onto the website as well. Now, the events of chapter 20, where before we know that the betrayal has happened and Krieger is saying, hey, you take refuge up on the upper levels, which will be easier to defend because I guess it'll be harder for the Wendigo to get up to the top levels, or, you know, potentially they could destroy the stairs or something. Who knows what Krieger's thinking is in telling them to go up there. Well, actually, no. We know exactly what his thinking is. He wants to be able to get away with Greta. Most of their stuff is actually downstairs because the upstairs has been in disuse. And they want James and Abigail, where they don't know something is going on, to be missing. But as it turns out, going upstairs is exactly what starts to give James and Abigail the clues that something is rotten in the state of Denmark, because James and Abigail are now looking at the bed of the room that they are in and noticing that it has three different kinds of hairs on it. In the original story, that was probably very much a, just like one of those moments that would have been dun, dun, dun. It makes one think of The Fall of the House of Usher, or here in the podcast, I deliberately made reference to a favorite movie of the Shaws, and I have edited that part out since even giving the name of the movie alludes to a major spoiler of that movie. Those of you that have both read Secret Rooms and seen the movie in question likely know what I'm talking about. And the only thing that I will add is that this is one of those times when the movie was not an influence, since this movie didn't come out till after the original edition of Secret Rooms was published. Any seeming connections between the two are shockingly coincidental.
Well, if nothing else, I'm sure it is always a no bad thing to see that you and the director whose work you admire go to similar places when you tell your gothic stories.
Yeah, exactly. This scene where they suddenly realize that it's very likely that all three of them were lovers, if they were sharing the same bed, it's enough of a dun-dun-dun moment in the original story. There is a lot of extra weight to it. Now that we know the relationship between James and Abigail and Lucy and the directions that could have gone, when you see the two of them looking at each other and coming to the same conclusion, it's hard not to imagine that that is going on in their heads as well, because while they don't get into it immediately, Lucy does eventually come up in the remaining chapters. So it's, yeah, it's one of those significant moments where it's hard not to wonder exactly what they are thinking. And of course, we can't know because we're still in the moment of the story where everything has been written down as journal entries rather than instinctive responses recorded into a Vox tube, which still wouldn't let us see inside their own heads anyway. Mm. The narrative has strong control over what is revealed to us. So we can't know what people are thinking unless James and Abigail, or in the future, whoever it is that's writing a journal entry, chooses to reveal their own inside thoughts.
Mm-hmm. I think the moment of silence is something that even the reader or listener engages in with that knowledge that they have. It becomes this unspoken agreement that we all know what we're thinking of and we are not going to acknowledge it. It speaks volumes. And I think that that's remarkable in the sense that whether you're listening to it or reading it, these are both media that don't incorporate a visual performance component. Sometimes the blank spaces speak as much as the filled in spaces. And I think this is one of those moments where it says so much without having to say anything at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now with this new information, and they're just suddenly talking about all of the things that have not been said or the deceptions that might have taken place, a noise rouses them and leads them downstairs to try and fend off invaders or to protect Krieger and Greta. And that's where the story suddenly takes a sharp turn into science fiction. Because one of the things that we've been covering in the podcast right now is that we already know that there is a multiverse, that there is magic, that there are other worlds. But for those of you that have just been reading along, while the Wendigo themselves are monsters and are fearsome and we don't know where they come from, there is still some sort of potential explanation for them in the real world. The basis for the Cartographer's Handbook was the twin books of the Zombie Survival Handbook and World War Z. And what is explained in those narratives is that there is a scientific explanation for how zombies can exist, and there is a sequence of events that lead for the virus that makes zombification possible being introduced back into the world basically by accident. So under those circumstances, this could still all be taking place in a rational, logical, scientific world. The wind door throws that out the window. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a wind door.
Woo! Title drop. Now you understand why we call our show what it's called.
Yeah. No John Cena music this time. I'm going to limit that meme to once per episode. The way the books were originally laid out, the term wind door was introduced in one of the final chapters of the Cartographer's Handbook. Because of the way that we've laid things out, this is potentially the reader's first experience with the portal that is later coined by Arlington. It might have been coined by someone else, but Arlington uses it in the handbook of the existence of something called a wind door. So this has got to be a bit of a shock, and it's part of the reason why this is another one of those moments where the title of the chapter holds two different meanings, because the game changes because things suddenly start to go wrong. The Wendigo show up in force and attack our heroes. Annie has to leave to get help. They are now under siege in the house. And on top of everything else, the two people that they were sworn to protect are suddenly just nope out of there using abilities that they have no frame of reference for and can't even manage to respond to in time. So, yeah, the game has changed on multiple levels here, and that's why I chose to stop our discussion of secret rooms here before getting into the final meat of the story going forward.
It's really bizarre reading and listening to this, even after all these times, and Windors are so woven into the meat of this series that we decided to name our podcast after them. But even with that, and even with the discussion of the previous chapter where Krieger is preparing not just James and Abigail, but the reader for, okay, here's a little fun thought. What if, you know, other dimensions, you know, ever thought about that? And it's sort of like, oh, okay, I guess. And then it disarms everyone because it's like, I thought we were just dealing in hypotheticals. You mean this shit is real?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that Krieger specifically talks about is the idea that the Wendigo didn't come from this world. They came from somewhere else. And now those words have more weight. It's not just that Krieger and Greta are escaping to safety in a place that is not our world. It now is like, oh, what if the Wendigo really did come from some other place? Fuck.
And it just, it's the same thread of logic that James followed, which is, well, if one portal to one other world can exist, how many other worlds are we dealing with, right? Like,
yeah.
Seriously, what's going on here? Where are we going?
Yeah.
And I have nothing else to say except... Tune in next time, and you got a lot to look forward to with Tiger's Eye.
Oh, so there are anthropomorphic cats? Ooh. All right.
I'm saying nothing.
They can go on the website and see the cover of Tiger's Eye. That's really not a spoiler.
The quite literally, cat is out of the bag. And with that, we close the wind door, and you finally know what the bloody hell I'm talking about when I say that.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to be shutting down the wind door for today. We've covered plenty for all of you to get into. And there's going to be even more meat for the final five chapters. So we'll see you next time.
Take care.
I went back and forth on what music to use for the outro. As it turns out, a very long conversation from both of us got trimmed down to a handy hour and a half, and I got through the editing process quick enough to release a full episode this week. That made the choice easier. From one of my and Sharon's favorite artists, here is Building a Mystery.
Your ass to wear in your suicide pose, and across
Okay. They, meaning the Barghest, will move on by morning, or alternative... Blep. Doing that again. gibbet.
Yeah, so anyway...
I know that, among other things, public television was one of those channels that would often pull things from other broadcasting companies, specifically the BBC. That's why I know about... Crap, I'm forgetting his name now. The Fourth Doctor. Because
Tom Baker.
Tom Baker, yes. My first experience with Tom Baker way back in the day was when they were airing his episodes of his run of Doctor Who on Channel 2. So, yeah. Our Channel 2, so to speak. Yeah.
Who would Tom Baker play in New Century?
God, that's an interesting question. Separating him from his, because I've never actually seen him play anyone other than the Doctor, so I don't have a good example of his range. Mm. So what we're actually asking is, if the Fourth Doctor was in New Century, who would he play? Oh, he might play the Nag.
I was thinking that he would be a he would make the Nag even more offbeat, I think, in a bizarre way. He is a villain in one of the Ray Harryhausen Sinbad films, the one with the six-armed statue that does the sword fight and everything. But and to be honest, he's probably one of the best actors in, apart from, you know, Harryhausen doing the stop motion animation himself. But don't get me started, otherwise I'll put together another draft for a chapter I'm working on.
That was a great moment, actually. I may try and, like, just cut and paste that being, like, a stinger at the end of... I don't know about this episode, but the end of an episode, because I don't think I don't want to waste that moment where we suddenly digress into who would Tom Baker be in New Century.
Yeah. So anyway,
what I eventually decided was that chapter 20 made for the better cliffhanger, because while chapters 18, I can't say words.
Yeah. So anyway,
in addition, it's in chapter 21 that there's a dramatic shift of storytelling. I should have mailed it to the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, so anyway...
See, in the meantime, I've never actually seen The Nightmare Before Christmas, but you mentioned Rankin Bass, and so while you're talking, in the back of my head I'm hearing, here's Mr. Old Christmas, here's Mr. Snow.
Mr. Snow. It's part of my actual thesis, I can't believe it.
Yeah, so anyway...
I don't know if I'm just going to... cue up the John Cena soundtrack every time we do the name drop of the book that we're talking about, but it's very tempting.
It's going to happen at least two or three times per book, because these are stories with multiple meanings to their titles. Mm. It's going to happen. Yeah. The most straightforward one is Arlington.
Yeah, so anyway...
This one particular movie in particular. I'm going to have to re-edit that. I just said particular two times in, like, 3 seconds. Anyway.
We'll fix it in post.
Fix it in post. Fuck it. We'll do it live.
We'll do it live.
But...
Only the freshest memes for our podcast.
But, no, in particular... God damn it! This is going to be hilarious to listen to when I actually do the edit.
And there is a moral to this story. Or there was supposed to be a moral to this story. But because I'm dyslexic, it is, in fact, a marble. Good night.